This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Take something iconic, like the all-electric 2024 Fiat 500e. Add something eléctrica. Bring the swagger. And an Italian icon is remixed and ready to drop with its available premium JBL audio system. Tap the banner to learn more. Fiat is a registered trademark of FCA Group Marketing SPA, used under license by FCA US LLC.
CeraVe Facial Moisturizers with SPF protect skin against damaging UV rays and continuously deliver three essential ceramides to help restore skin's protective barrier so it can lock in moisture. Non-greasy, fragrance-free, and won't clog pores? With CeraVe, skin feels hydrated and looks healthy all day. CeraVe Facial Moisturizers with SPF from the number one dermatologist recommended facial moisturizer brand.
With Capella University's FlexPath format, you can set your own deadlines, learn at your pace, and access most coursework from anywhere at any time. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Hello, and welcome to the Rookie Chef Podcast with me, Nadia Zirfat, where I'll be interviewing some brilliant chefs about their exceptional recipes. We did this recording at home, so sometimes the audio quality might not be what we would expect in the studio. This week, I'm joined by chef, presenter and founder of the School of Wok, and we're going to be discussing Thai green curry. Hi, Jeremy. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great. Thank you. As good as can be.
Yeah.
Stuck at home in many different ways.
Yeah, aren't we all? So for anyone that doesn't know, could you just give us a lowdown of the key elements of a Thai green curry?
Yeah, look, it always starts with the pestle and mortar before the ingredients, I think, for a proper Thai green curry. So, I always say with Thai food, the pestle and mortar is probably the most important bit of equipment that you need, because you kind of want to squeeze all the oils out of all the herbs and spices. But essentially you've got a Thai green curry paste that you got to make. And then you just have to love your curry. give it time. You got to fry off the paste and the spices. And then as you go sort of through it, you sort of gradually add the coconut milk, or, and depending what meat or fish or, you know, even tofu and veg you're putting in there, you know, that needs to be almost seared into the paste before you get into the rest of the curry. I'm happy to go through like each and every step in a much more intricate way, when you're ready.
Yeah. So, You talk about how important the pestle and mortar is in creating the paste. What do you think that a paste can give that a shop-bought jar of Thai green curry paste can't?
Okay, yeah. I mean, there's so many different types of jars of Thai green curry paste. And I say sort of in inverted commas paste, because like some of the more sort of Western jars of curry paste, I would say are definitely, you know, they're probably mixed with quite a lot of liquid or water or coconut milk already and things like that.
Yeah.
And those sort of pastes are definitely in my inverted commas. I wouldn't call those pastes. You can get sort of more authentic Thai curry pastes. But again, because they have to sort of sit on shelf for quite a long time, they might have preservatives, additives, even sort of it might be hard to sort of avoid things like MSG in them and things like that. And I think like when you make it from scratch, you make it fresh, it's a completely different feeling.
Yeah.
You know, the end product, your final dish, is always going to be far more tasty because, you know, if you're using fresh herbs, fresh and all fresh paste ingredients, then you're sort of bringing the oils out, you know, literally at the time of cooking, and that's what makes the difference, you know. And perhaps this is a good time to go into what's actually in a good sort of fresh Thai green curry paste. The things that might be easier to find are your garlics and your green chili. Garlic, green chili, lemongrass these days is pretty easy to find. Coriander root we use. So I think a lot of people tend to sort of throw away the coriander, the stems of coriander and the root of coriander, but that's got so much flavor in it and also texture. So we always use coriander root in a good green curry paste. And then Thai shallots or normal shallots or swap it out with just normal onion. That's also fine. Thai shallots, everything in sort of Thai herb or ingredients tends to be slightly more sweet and doesn't quite hit the back of your throat and more citrusy than you would have your classic sort of onions or shallots, Western onions and shallots. So the same with your galangal, for example. So we're moving into more sort of, I guess, exotic territory here where you wouldn't necessarily get galangal or kaffir lime leaves in sort of all the major supermarkets, Western supermarkets. But they, for me, are core ingredients to a good Thai green curry paste. You know, galangal, if I want to explain that, is very much taking that concept of ginger. Like, if you can't find galangal, you can swap it out with ginger, but it won't taste exactly the same.
Yeah.
It will give you a good green curry paste. It just won't be exactly the same. And that citrusy flavour that comes off of galangal, it's kind of like almost like a citrus menthol ginger.
Yeah. sounds very different to your standard ginger that you get in your local supermarket or...
Yeah, it is. And it's rock solid. It's not something that you can necessarily like bash with a cleaver. You know, like, yeah. So whereas ginger, you can. So you want to take your galangal, when you're chopping into it, you really got to chop into it really as finely as possible first before it goes into pestle and mortar. And kaffir lime leaves are one of those things that I always have in my freezer just because I am who I am, but not everyone would have that. You can buy dry kaffir lime leaves, but personally, I feel like they don't add anything. There's no taste to dried lime leaves. Similarly to dried curry leaf, I just feel like if you can't get fresh, just leave it out. And if you can't find kaffir lime leaves, then you can swap it out with things like a little bit of lime pith, or you know, like a lime peel, or and just grate it in. Again, not 100% necessary. But so the idea is just to reiterate. So if you've got your shallots or onions, garlic, green, lots of green chilies. Like if we're talking like 2 to 3 cloves of garlic, I might use like 8 to 12 whole large green chilies in this curry paste. And one of the sort of best things about green curry paste or any curry paste is that you can make lots, always make lots and freeze what you don't use.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that on the phone the other day and I was really surprised that you could freeze it, because it kind of makes the whole experience of making a curry a lot less daunting. Because if you sort of make a big batch, you freeze some, then that's half of it done, right? Well, maybe not half, a quarter, but that's a lot of the work done already. And then you can just sort of have it on tap, I guess.
Absolutely. Actually, at the beginning of lockdown in March, I made a huge batch of curry paste and I used it for so many different dishes. It wasn't just for a Thai green curry. You know, you can use it for stir fries. You can use it to sort of marinate chicken or meat and then roast it. You know, whatever you want, you can use, because it's got all those great ingredients in there. And I think it took about 4 months in the freezer to get through that green curry paste.
So
I use it on a weekly basis.
Yeah. How long would you say it lasts for once you freeze it? And also, what's the best way to freeze it?
6 months.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Possibly even longer. The best way is to do it in a thin layer on greaseproof paper on top of a baking tray. So you freeze it in that thin layer so that once it's frozen, the next day, take it out of the freezer and then put it into a food bag and just crack it and like into smaller pieces.
So it's not in a solid lump and then it's hard to sort of get the amount that you need.
Exactly. You could do it in ice cube trays as well.
But, I love that trick. I found that one out recently and it just blew my mind.
Yeah, exactly. Because then you've got one little piece for each curry, you know.
Yeah.
But I quite like this sort of thin layer because that means that you can take little bits depending on what you want. You know, you don't always have to have the same ice cube amount. Yeah. The only other things I'm missing into that sort of finely chopped sort of set of ingredients would be, so classically you'd have things like lesser ginger in there as well, which is something that you definitely can't find here in the UK that often. In Chinatown they always have it. In most sort of Thai supermarkets and Vietnamese supermarkets, you'll probably find it. Another name for it is finger ginger because it kind of looks like long fingers, like kind of good for this sort of time around Halloween, I guess, you know. Yeah. But lesser ginger is like a sweeter, less citrus, more bittersweet sort of type of ginger, similarly to turmeric. And we put turmeric into this as well because turmeric, the colour sort of, the yellow almost accentuates the green of the curry. I tend to, if you can, use fresh turmeric root in the paste because, it's got a sort of fresher flavour. You get the oils and the sort of moisture that comes out of that as well. It will give you the best curry paste for sure.
Yeah.
And then the last ingredient that we put into that is it tends to be about half to one teaspoon of shrimp paste. And that's the sort of classic, like deep savory flavour that you'll get from your Thai curries that sort of combines with the fish sauce and seasoning later on in the actual cooking of the curry.
Yeah. That's a lot of incredible ingredients in there. As you've said, it's, you know, a lot of them aren't necessarily readily available in your local supermarket. So you'd say the best places to buy them would be sort of Thai supermarkets, Vietnamese. Yeah. Is there anywhere?
Yeah, and online as well. Yeah. There's a few online Asian supermarkets now that you can buy these types of ingredients.
Yeah.
One thing is that it's very, as you almost can only make it in bulk because if you get like one small pack of galangal, it'll give you enough for like, you know, 20 green curries. You know? So, you know, be prepared to sort of get that pestle and mortar going. And the thing is, like, you really need to like finely chop all those ingredients, combine them all together in the pestle and mortar. We have a little tip in at School of Wok, and that is, like, don't put your shallots in until last, and along with your shrimp paste, because A, they're very, the shrimp paste is really smelly. And
there's no other way to put it. Keep your kitchen scent free as long as possible.
Just open it for as short a time as possible, that pot of shrimp paste. and then the Thai shallots, like much like onions, you know, they'll make you cry for 20 minutes of pounding. So get everything else pounding first. And then you want to get that paste to a really like a smoother paste and a unanimous paste rather than like bits of ingredients. Yeah. And that could take a 15 to 20 minute sort of set of pounding.
Yeah. Speaking of onions, do you have any tips to stop yourself from crying? Because I always leave them until last because my eyes just, I can't see by the end of it.
I've tried numerous different ways and our YouTube School of Wok audience have like told us many, many different ways because I'm constantly crying on the videos. So, there's been like goggles.
Goggles at one point, but...
apparently like bite a piece of bread or hold a teaspoon in your mouth or something like that. Like, so I said to the guys, actually, what we should try is try all of the techniques that have been suggested on our YouTube channel in one go and see whether that works.
That would be a sight, wouldn't it? It's kind of like hiccups. Everyone has their favourite way of stopping hiccups, but do any of them actually work? I don't know.
Scaring definitely works.
Really?
Yeah, or a combination. Like, drink, have, hold some water in your mouth and get scared at the same time.
Oh my gosh, that just sounds painful. See, I'm going to try that now. And if it works, then I'll take your advice on anything you say about onions, because I feel like you've tried and tested both things.
There should probably be a disclaimer on that one for don't try this at home. But anyway, yeah.
So speaking of School of Wok, I think you mentioned the other day that Thai green curry is one of your most popular courses.
Yes, yeah. I mean, we have like an introduction to Thai cuisine course at the school, and I started the school in just Chinese food, but now it's like Chinese, all types of Southeast Asian, Korean, and Japanese cooking, and the Thai ones for sure were the sort of the second quickest to fill up a few years back, and now they're just as popular as the Chinese classes, and we did. Sort of at one point, I think we took our original like Thai green curry, somtam salad and Thai spring roll menu off our class list. And we got quite a few complaints from customers
really?
About it. So we had to bring it back in.
What do you think makes it so popular? That's a very hard question, but in your opinion.
It's a Moorish nature of like, that perfect balance of Asian cooking, I think. Yeah. And a Thai green curry sort of holds that. If it's cooked well, it holds that perfect balance really well. Because with Thai food, what you want is a balance of like sweet, sour, savory, salty, like all in the same sort of bite.
Yeah.
But I always talk about a balance of flavor, texture, and color as well in all types of Asian cooking, not just Thai. So if you get that perfect balance right, then we used to do a lot of consulting for chefs and restaurants. And when I was sort of teaching about Asian cooking, it's like, if you get the perfect balance of flavor, texture, and color, then when you sort of go in for one bite, you've had that bite and it's delicious the first bite. You want to then go in for the second, third, or fourth bite. But even if that dish was like cold, it taking you so long to eat, not that it would if it tastes so good, then you would still want to go in for more.
Yeah.
and that's what is the epitome of Moorish food. Like, you know, something that really you just keep wanting to go back for more. If you get that perfect balance, you're guaranteed to have created that like Moorish comfort food feel. Yeah. And so that's why I think a Thai green curry is so popular, because it not only has that perfect balance of flavors, as I've said, sweetness from the coconut milk, saltiness and spiciness from the base spices and the fish sauce, and then all combined together, and the citrus flavors and this almost slight sweet sour from things like your kaffir lime and then whatever ingredients you put in it, you add the textures on top of that, you know, you're going to get a really good Moorish dish. Yeah.
So what goes into your research when you're sort of discovering how to perfect a certain dish? How do you get to that end result where you feel like it's exactly what you're looking for and you're ready to teach other people how to make it? And
right. I mean, I consider myself quite fortunate in the sense that since a young age, my family, you know, traveled a lot. Having lived in Southeast Asia, I lived in Singapore with my family when I was around 10. That's when my sort of foodie journey really started. Having lived there and dotted around all these different Southeast Asian countries at a young age, I sort of picked up a palate and a taste for that, this type of food anyway. I think when I'm testing recipes now, like if I don't know something and I want to try something new and I possibly haven't even gone to that country to eat that food, I don't just look at sort of one recipe and just cook it straight away. I might look at like 10 or 20 recipes. And I guess because I write recipes now, it's slightly easier. I can kind of look at a recipe and go, you know what, either the ingredients list of that is really great and authentic and it's got a great traditional base to it, or even if it's slightly modern, I don't mind that. I encourage it for sure.
Yeah.
But also the written sort of method of that recipe If I really don't know how to cook something, then I want to look for how that is written and go, okay, well, that I'm learning something here. I can take something from this recipe.
Yeah.
And then I might look at sort of 5, 10, 20 recipes, depending on how complex the dish is, and then go, okay, make my own mind up as to which out of those sort of few recipes, what, you know, what bits of advice I can take from each of those recipes.
Yeah, definitely.
Before I then create my own. Yeah.
And I think it's a lot down to personal taste as well, or what sort of flavors you prefer it with some recipes. Sort of, I know when I first started really looking into how to cook a recipe, mm-hmm. at first I would just sort of read the list, read the method, and follow it to a T.
Yeah.
But as I've got more comfortable in the kitchen, I find myself adding stuff and, you know, tasting it along the way and deciding, oh, I think maybe, you know, more of this or less of this.
Right. And you are you're bang on. That's exactly how everyone should cook. Like, yeah. You know, in my view, because like I'm not a big fan of the word authentic.
Yeah.
Because I believe in tradition and I'm quite a traditional type of person, but like, I also love like new ideas and new takes on things. And cooking is like the perfect practical or physical activity for like creating something new.
Yeah.
Sometimes even knowing that you've created something new. And so you might take a traditional thing, like a really traditional thing like this, like a Thai green curry, where, you know, you're creating, like over time, as you get more confident, you're putting new ingredients into it. You might cook your paste off slightly differently to someone else. And of course it starts from a base from maybe like a few hundred or thousand years ago where someone has cooked this the first time. But every time someone else cooks it, they might cook it that little bit differently, you know, and if it tastes good, I don't care.
Me too.
You know, by the end of it, you know, you just want a good tasty meal that you're happy to cook again. Yeah.
And I was speaking to my dad last night about how he sort of comes to the end result and is happy with what he's cooked or created. And he said,
spring is a time of renewal. So why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
It's hard not to add a side of hot, crispy hash browns to your favorite McDonald's breakfast. It's even harder not to eat said hash browns before you get home. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
This episode is brought to you by Rakuten. Are you ready to shop? Rakuten's Big Give Week is back. Get 15% cash back at hundreds of stores, including headliners, Ulta, Ray-Ban, and Canon. Rakuten is how in-the-know shoppers get the best savings. They shop the brands they love and earn cash back on top of deals during Big Give Week, May 6th to May 13th. The cash back rates are even bigger. I'll be shopping for Adidas and Fenty. You can save on everything you need for summer, like clothing, outdoor gear, and travel. Join today for free and get an extra 10% cash back boost. That's an extra 10% cash back on top of Big Give Week's 15% cash back. You won't see higher cash back rates than these. Go to Rakuten.com or download the Rakuten app. Rakuten. Shoppers get it.
You can have a recipe that's been passed down in your family and, you know, thousands of people have cooked it and he's cooked it thousands of times, but a lot of it is to do with the seasons, how, say, the vegetables or the ingredients are different month by month, you know, year by year. And that's why it's so important to taste it as you go along, because you can follow a recipe to the T, but there are so many different factors that can influence the end result.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, everyone's hobs are different. You know, someone might be cooking on
induction,
raw
gas.
Fire versus induction. And
yeah.
Like, does that matter? Not really, you know, so long as you can get the heat and understand that moving and changing heat around, like, will change the way that your dish turns out in the end. You know, that sort of stuff. Like, that's why for me, like, education and teaching is so much fun, because like it everyone will cook that differently. You know, when I started teaching, when I started School of Wok, I was actually teaching at a college as well in London. And I'd have about 20 students in one room. And actually wok cooking is so fast, like things can happen within like minutes, you know. And so like being able to look and watch each one of the 20 students over a 2 minute period is just not physically possible.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
So what we used to do after a few weeks was actually I'd teach the core principles of wok cooking to those students, and then I'd get them to bring their dishes to me, their final dishes to me, not having actually watched any of them cook it. And then I'd teach them how to critique each one of the dishes on how it was cooked, not necessarily how it tasted, but how each dish was cooked by just looking at it. You know, and each and every one of those 20 dishes every week would come out that slightly differently, because each student had cooked it in a slightly different way, and perhaps the heat wasn't quite up at the right time on certain dishes versus another, you know. And so it's about changing heat, understanding when to do that. And but, you know, as I say, if it tastes great, I don't care.
Yeah, definitely. What would you say are the top three mistakes, or even one, that people make when they're making a Thai green curry at home?
Okay. The first mistake is using a jar.
Yeah.
for the paste. even if you can't find the more obscure ingredients, like, just get some onion, garlic, ginger and some lemongrass and some green chilies, and you'll make a good Thai green curry paste.
Yeah.
The second mistake would be sort of not frying your spices off and not frying that paste properly. So you need to give that time. And what I say is, when you're cooking your spices, your paste, it might take sort of anything up to sort of 5 to 10 minutes, depending on the speed of your hob. And you need to cook your paste through until your curry paste doesn't smell raw and grassy. So it needs to be fragrant, but not grassy in aroma. And then after that, the third thing is getting the sort of texture of the sauce right. We tend to add coconut milk really quite gradually. So you start, once your paste is fried, your meat's gone in and fried into the paste, when you start adding your coconut milk, you add it a little bit at a time. So the reason why we do that is if you try and separate out the oil of the coconut milk from the actual solids, that the sort of intense flavor of that curry paste mixed into coconut milk really accentuates. So you take like a couple of tablespoons at a time, and then when it comes to boil, you mix it in, you know, and then you add another couple of tablespoons, and then you might go for half a can, bring that to a boil, and then add the rest.
Yeah. So it's a gradual process.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is why I said at the beginning, you need to love your curry, you know, you need to take your time over it to do that. Yeah.
So is there any other advice that you give to someone once they're cooking the curry itself?
I think essentially once your coconut milk has all gone in, then you want to let that curry sort of simmer and boil on a sort of medium heat for, you know, 20 minutes to half an hour. Yeah. And that during that time, your sort of coconut milk your curry sauce will sort of start to thicken bit by bit. I tend to sort of almost take this slightly Indian approach to this, where if it sticks a little on the bottom of the pan, you kind of want that because that's creating more flavor. And you allow it to stick to the bottom of a pan and only stir it every sort of 10 minutes or so, so that you can then scrape any flavor of those spices and stickiness off the bottom of the pan. And then once you've gotten that far, if you have any like sort of meatier vegetables or harder vegetables that need cooking, like carrots or aubergine and things like that, those can go into to the curry sort of closer to that beginning, or you know, with the chicken or with the meat or once the coconut milk has all gone in. And then any sort of quicker cooked vegetables, like sugar snap peas, or you know, like some people like baby corn in theirs, or you know, things like that, like that you want to keep crunchy, put in the last sort of 3 to 5 minutes. Let them overcook. And then the last process is just seasoning it. So you need to season it try and find that balance. We've got the spicy in there, we've got natural sweetness from the coconut milk, but to find that balance and almost accentuate or amplify that balance of flavor, you need your fish sauce for saltiness and savory, and that's going to complement the shrimp paste that's in the curry paste. And that fish sauce, you're going in tablespoons with fish sauce. Like usually it's about 2 to 3 tablespoons in a sort of 2 to 4 person portion of fish sauce. But go by taste, you know, go tablespoon at a time, because everyone's got different salt palate, you know. So once you're happy with the saltiness that fish sauce has created, then you want to balance that saltiness out with some palm sugar or brown sugar or normal sugar. And the palm sugar or the sugar, yes, it's adding sweetness, but it's to balance out the saltiness of the fish sauce, but also to accentuate the sweetness of the coconut milk. Got it? So the fish sauce brings out the savory base of the curry paste, and the sugar brings out the sweetness of the coconut milk.
Yeah. And I asked the BBC Good Food Together Facebook group what they'd like to hear from you, what sort of expert tips they'd like. Yeah. And John Datta said, other than chicken, what works best as a protein? I've tried and liked salmon, but wondered if there were any other options that pair well.
Yeah, salmon's great. With fish and things, obviously, it doesn't take as long to cook. So the general gist would be for me, like to make your curry sauce, put whatever veg you want in there or longer cooked veg in there, and then put your salmon in last 10 minutes. So like prawns work fantastically. I'm a big fan, as most Asians are, of like prawns with shell on rather than like just sort of peeled and deveined prawns. The shell adds a lot of like natural savory flavor to anything you cook. So you can either sear the prawns and then put them in, or you can just butterfly them, take out the vein and keep the shell and put them straight in. And then, you know, different types of tofu works really well in Thai green curry. You get this sort of deep fried, what the Chinese we call it dal phu bok, which is like little pockets of deep fried tofu. And because it's deep fried, it's really spongy and therefore soaks in sauce like a sponge.
Yeah.
So when you bite into it, it will soak in all that delicious sauce. And that's why I think tofu really works well in
that
the Thai green curry.
Yeah. What's your favorite?
I like a combination of it
all. Oh, greedy.
But yeah, I mean, you know, like I quite like green chicken curry, but yeah. I would put the deep fried tofu in there as well.
I'm definitely going to try that. That sounds incredible, especially when tofu. I think a lot of people think tofu is bland, but I feel like that's because it hasn't been cooked properly. When it's cooked properly, it really soaks the flavor up, doesn't it?
Yeah, tofu is there. If you tasted tofu by itself, of course it's bland, but it's there to be cooked into a delicious sauce
and
soak up the flavour of that sauce. Yeah.
Amazing. And Lucy Waite said, how do you get the sauce thick, as mine is always really runny?
Okay. My guess is that Lucy is either adding stock or water into the curry. And yeah, in northern like Thailand, you'll get green curries without coconut milk quite a lot. So there's no issue with that. That what you need though is the right sort of cooking technique, and that is slowly. So as opposed to there's a difference between braising something and boiling something. Like if you boil something, you put water into a pan, bring it to a boil, and the pan's cold. It may well be cold or warm or not hot enough. If you're braising something, you've got something sizzling on a medium to high heat in a pan already. And then when you add liquid to it, if it instantly boils instantly vigorously boils, then you know that you're braising something, not boiling. And therefore your sauce will eventually thicken over time, especially with a good coconut milk. So if you're cooking your Thai green curry, as I have in the recipe here, with a whole can of coconut milk, that coconut milk will thicken over time, but you've got to pour it into that hot pan of cooking paste.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've given us such wonderful information about cooking a Thai green curry. If you go to a restaurant or get a takeaway, what would you say are the main things that you should be looking for that marks a great Thai green curry?
Definitely going back to that last question, I think thickness of the sauce is important. So it's like really wrapping around your curry. And aroma, for me, you can tell whether a Thai green curry has been cooked from scratch or from a pre-made paste just from smelling it.
Yeah, definitely.
if you walk into a restaurant, you go, oh wow, that smells so fragrant and aromatic, then it's likely that green curry or those curries have been made with a lot of love.
Yeah. So I'd love to know a bit more about you personally. Obviously, when people have such a passion for food, they usually go down the restaurant route, opening their own restaurant. What inspired you to open a cookery school?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one. When I was much younger, sort of in my early teens, I did have this dream of opening a restaurant one day. But I think quite quickly wisened up to the fact that I would be stuck to stuck to the restaurant all day, every day. And, and also having done sort of a little bit of learning in a sort of culinary institute in at the Cordon Bleu, I've sort of figured out at that point that I didn't want to be a restaurant chef.
Yeah.
And I also didn't want to necessarily own a restaurant. My passion is definitely communication and watching other people not just enjoy their food but enjoy the process of food.
Yeah.
and cooking. And so when I was at the Cordon Bleu, I sort of found that sort of passion. And then I was in and out of marketing. I studied biochemical engineering at uni. I went into marketing for different big companies. And then I did this sort of basic cuisine course at the Cordon Bleu in between, which is only 3.5 months. I couldn't afford the whole year. It was very expensive. So when I sort of was at the end of one of my last marketing jobs, and my father, passed away, unfortunately, in 2009. At that point, I lost my job and on the day of my dad's burial, and I kind of went, what do I want to do? And it was a question of, where do I go? I wanted to do something in food.
You're at crossroads, really.
Yeah, exactly. And I was at the height of the recession, 2009. And I kind of went, right, well, I want to do something in food, but I don't want to open a restaurant. I also don't want to be a restaurant chef. My wife suggested, she said, you're really sort of patient and you're great at teaching things. Why don't you teach cooking instead? Why don't you teach? And I was kind of like, okay, that's a great idea. I just started teaching people in their own homes, and that's how School of Wok started. And it was a very I was thrown in that situation because I didn't have a job. But I kind of just ran with it. And after about 6 months, so at first it was called sort of family friends and or like friends of friends who went, oh yeah, I'm really interested in that. After about 6 months, I think over 50% of my customers came from Google. So which was like, it's still small. It was only like two or three classes a week, but that was still, it kind of showed me that I was doing something right. And,
yeah.
And sort of, you know, my first few customers were really very, very kind, and I'm still really actually close friends with the sort of two or three of my customers from like 10, 11 years ago. And what I guess I found myself in this position where I'm also now doing radio or TV and things like that, because I genuinely have a passion for teaching others and want people to share that passion.
So I was going to ask a question about whether you prefer, you know, teaching, presenting or cooking, but it seems like the teaching element kind of comes into all of those things. Every sort of job you do is about teaching others how to cook and sort of how to get the basics down and
absolutely.
I guess getting that passion for themselves.
Yeah, look, whether you're, in my view, whether I'm teaching a class of 10 people, a crowd of, you know, 500 people, or I'm teaching thousands of people through a camera, it's no different.
Yeah.
Like, you know, at the end of the day, it's communication and getting people enthusiastic and excited about cooking this type of food. And, you know, but you got to bear in mind, I was trained in Western cooking, you know, not in Asian cooking. Perhaps because of my background, I've sort of found a place in the Asian food scene. And I have definitely got a huge passion for the type of food that we teach. But it's just food in general that I love talking about and sharing that knowledge with, and also learning from other people. It doesn't matter where people come from, whether they're chef or not. Yeah.
So do you feel like your training in Western cooking has helped your current role at all? Or do you feel
massively,
like they're just...
Massive.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, it's all combined, you know. At the end of the day, my big learning over the last sort of 10, 11 years, and even before, is that it's core techniques of cooking that make you, like, allow you to cook whatever you want. Yeah. So whether it's, like, Western or Asian cooking, those core techniques generally are going to be pretty similar. The only one in Chinese cooking that I would say is like completely unique that that Western cuisine doesn't have is wok cooking. Really, like everything else, like you've got like, you know, deep frying, steaming, poaching, braising, you know, these days sous vide cooking, you know, all those sorts of things like can spread across any type of cuisine.
Yeah. And I'm sure you get a lot of beginners in your classes who have no idea how to cook at all. So what would your advice be to people who are at the very start of their journey, just beginning to learn to cook? Do you have any advice to give them?
Yeah. The advice is probably sort of going back to the last bit of the conversation. And that is, once you've learned sort of those core, you know, 6 to 10 techniques of cooking things, then you can then start to be really creative. And as you're sort of finding, you can start to add your own ingredients or choose your own ingredients and maybe slightly change that technique slightly to your liking. But until you've learned those core techniques, and those are the traditional, I guess, more authentic sides to cooking, like until you've learned those techniques, then you're always going to struggle. So, you know, knife skills, really important, no matter what cuisine. And then you've got your frying or pan frying or deep frying. You've got your poaching and braising and what the differences are between those. Roasting techniques are really important in all types of cuisine, probably more so in Western cuisine than in Asian cuisine, because not that many people in Asia actually have ovens. But in old traditional restaurant senses, there's always been sort of clay ovens and things like that. And then double cooking in Chinese is what we call like piecing together two or more of those core techniques.
Yeah.
You know, so obviously with Chinese food, as I said, we've got wok cooking and stir frying, which is another technique. But once you've learned those sort of 6, 7 core techniques, then you can move around the kitchen and do what you want and be as creative as you want.
I think that's excellent advice, because it is kind of daunting when you first start to cook. I mean, I've cooked all my life, but I've never really been into cooking, if that makes sense. I haven't put the time into really learning, right. But it's only sort of recently that I really do want to learn how to sort of adapt dishes and make my own and right. learn about all the different flavors and elements to cooking. So I think that's fantastic advice for sort of discovering how to do that, I guess.
Sure. So who did all the cooking before you started cooking?
Well, to be honest, I actually cook a lot at home, but right. I wasn't very adventurous with it. So I sort of, like I said, I'd follow a recipe, but I wouldn't sort of think about what I had done right or right. wrong and adapt sure. it and change it to my taste. I'd sort of just follow it. I wouldn't taste along the way, yeah. which is, as I'm told by my mum, terrible. She yeah. says you need to taste along the way constantly. But I think it's recently being surrounded, obviously in the job that I do, being surrounded by people who have such a passion for cooking and know so much, it's yeah. really opened my eyes to the fact that I think I was kind of scared of failure. I was scared of trying stuff and, you know, adapting it and then it turning absolutely terrible and everything's burnt and it's too salty and, it, you know, I just give sure. up. But I think you can only really learn through failure.
Sure, sure. So, you know, one of my things is like, I believe that if you know how to eat, you will know how to cook.
I definitely know how to eat. You know, like that's one of my talents.
Some people, especially like beginners, are maybe a little bit less, you know, they haven't got the confidence. They kind of say, I just don't know how to cook. It's like, well, do you know how to eat? Like,
yeah.
do you like, what do you like? Do you like this? And what do you like about it? You know, look, what do you like about a Thai green curry? Why is it so tasty to you? You know, and then when they start to explain those things, then I'm like, oh, you're teaching me already. Yeah. You know, like, you know, yeah. and that's just it. You know, I like with my 3-year-old, he's not the best eater, like I have to admit. But over lockdown, he's gotten a little bit better. And little things like watching films like Ratatouille have yeah. helped, you know, like, and that is like that concept of like gusto, where it's like, you know, everyone can cook. I kind of like agree with that, you know, like everyone can cook. It's in everyone, you know, it's in everyone's blood, because you have to eat like at yeah. least 2 or 3 times a day, you know, so like, so you just physically will get there if you're either taught right or you've got that exploratory nature within you to go, oh, how did someone actually make that? Yeah.
Well, I think that's all we have time for, but thank you so much. I've learned an incredible amount of information and knowledge, and I feel like I can really nail the Thai green curry now, as well as probably many other types of cooking after that. So
it's
thank
my
you.
Pleasure. It's my pleasure. Yeah.
Join us next time, where I'll be learning the secrets behind another favourite dish. Thank you. And that was the Rookie Chef Podcast with me, Nadia Zirfat. To get the recipe and find out more, go to bbcgoodfood.com/podcast and make sure to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts to never miss an episode.